Okay, welcome to the seminar today. We have a talk on outreach and science communication by Ottoli. Probably you know her, and she will introduce herself, so please.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks everyone for coming, even if you seem to be on, that's fine. So for those of you that don't know me, I'm Ottoli, I'm studying physics, so astrophysics physics at the University of Bath. I'm currently doing science communication placement here at PUD. Today I'm going to be talking about navigating a new era of science communication. So the topics we're going to cover, starting off with what actually is science communication. So it's pretty self-explanatory. It's sharing scientific ideas, practices, results with various audiences. So these could range anywhere from school children and young people all the way up to other scientists, policymakers, funding bodies. And the type of communication that we do really depends on the audience that we're trying to target and the message that we want them to take home. So type of things could be press releases, media visits, social media posts, managing a website, outreach events, exhibits. And how do we actually define good science communication? This is just a little analogy that I came up with. So I like to think that good science is often shared through science communication, and through this we can help with public understanding of science, we can get people engaged and supporting science. This can help with funding, policy support, and also promoting diversity in science, which then in turn leads back to what good science that we can share. So one thing I wanted to touch on before I get into the bulk of my seminar is this conference, PERI conference, which I went to back in March of this year. It's inspired a lot of the things I'm going to be talking about today. So PERI is for public awareness and engagement with research infrastructures. So it's a group of science communicators and science journalists, both freelance and embedded in research infrastructures as I am. And the theme of this year was navigating science communication in a shifting landscape. And what I really enjoyed about this conference is that there were many different interpretations of this shifting landscape. So some people spoke about new emerging technologies. Some people spoke about shifting political landscapes and the impact this has on science, and also shifting media landscapes. So that's inspired a lot of what I'm going to be talking about today. But the key message is that science communication is changing. So what are some of these changes? Arguably the biggest is the shift from traditional media, which is things like newspapers, TV, radio, lectures, towards so-called new media, which is predominantly social media, YouTube, and podcasts. So with this shift, practically anyone can create content. There's platforms and tools to create and share science-related information for little to no cost, which does mean there's been a massive boom in the amount of content that's being shared, which is a really good thing. It's increased, sort of democratized science, made it available to everyone. And it's with it being new media, this is particularly targeting younger generations, which is great because they're having exposure to science outside of the classroom. But obviously there are some downsides. So the first is that we have fragmented audiences. They're split across all these different platforms, and you have hundreds of thousands of creators across all these platforms that are competing for attention. This means it can be hard to get accurate science information shared. What it really requires is sort of tailored platform-specific content. So if you have a new result or a new paper, instead of just putting out a press release and letting the media sort of take it, you might need to also post on social media. And within that, it's not one message across all the different platforms. You might have to adapt the video, create a video to go with it, adapt the text, etc. So this can make it hard and time consuming to accurately share scientific information. Along with the massive amount of information that's being shared, we do have misinformation and disinformation, which are slightly different. So misinformation is false or misleading information shared without intent to harm, so often by mistake. whereas disinformation often has bad intents to deceive or manipulate. And this is very prevalent on social media because it's really hard to police, and it's also hard to verify credibility of content you see online. Often people without a scientific background can create content that is just as polished as someone with scientific background. And we've seen this particularly affecting things like vaccine safety, climate change, and attitudes towards 5G as well. There was an interesting study at MIT back in 2018, which studied 126,000 rumor cascades. A rumor cascade is essentially someone posting a piece of fake news and the amount of people that sort of share it and spread it. So they looked at information that was spread by approximately 3 million people over just over a decade. And alarmingly, they found that fake news was 70% more likely to be reshared than true news, and it also spread about 6 times faster. And they did sort of their eyes on the possible reasons for this, and it seems to be a sort of psychological thing, because often fake news is emotional, it's shocking, and therefore people are more likely to share it, even if they don't agree with it. They might share it and be like, oh wow, look at this piece of fake news, but that is still giving it airtime and attention. This is a nice little example from a talk at Harry, actually. So back in April of 2024, one of the LHC restarts coincided with a total solar eclipse with a candidate from USA. And there was a lot of conspiracy theorists. This is my personal favorite. A company in Switzerland called Zerg opened up a portal to other dimensions. What they're allegedly attempting to do is summon demonic entities on the earth. I'm not making this up, do your own research. So, obviously, there's a lot of nonsense being shared, or a lot of nonsense was shared around this particular topic, but also there were people that were genuinely curious and worried. So this one down here is from a 15-year-old that says, I'm only 15 and I'm really scared. Can anybody explain this more to me? So it is something that does need to be addressed when something like this happens, because as you can see, this is again from the talk. So this is the social media engagement, visits to the website, and mentions in the press around the time of the 8th of April when these conspiracy theories are being shared. As you can clearly see, there's a big spike in all of them. So it is something that needs to be addressed and monitored, and there's various ways you can do this. They suggested sort of opening up a dialogue rather than directly trying to shoot people down, because a lot of the time conspiracy theorists won't accept that. Exactly saying, no, that's not true. So trying to open up the dialogue. Also audience mapping, trying to work out why people are saying these things, whether they're conspiracy theorists, whether they're critics, or people that are just generally concerned and would like to understand what's going on, and also mapping people geographically. So I think that was just a nice example to share. Then moving on to AI, which again was a big theme at the conference. It's very polarizing for communicators, well, for everyone, but for communicators. So it poses a big threat, because at the minute we're seeing AI-generated text, images, and video that are slowly becoming indistinguishable from real content. This is obviously, if you're not trained or you haven't had any exposure to how to actually be able to tell the difference, it can pose a real threat. AI search tools such as like ChatGPT and Claude are also surfacing unverified claims and false information, which is particularly concerning. But then on the flip side, a lot of science communicators are seeing AI tools that are benefiting communication. So there's tools like Elicit and Semantic Scholar, which essentially you can put in a question or a topic and it will find and synthesize scientific literature for you. So then you can go on and read the paper. This is often helpful for science communicators who don't have a scientific background and aren't aware of the process of finding scientific literature. And it's also, there's tools that can be used for things like translation, which is particularly useful if you want to expand the reach of a piece of information, and then summarizing and personalizing content as well. But one thing I want to touch on more is the AI search tools, because this is a particularly prevalent issue. So a recent study showed that 58% of people are replacing traditional searches with generative AI. So essentially, the old way of searching for information was someone would go onto Google or Bing or their browser, they type in a question, they'd be given a list of links, and they can go and select the link and decide if it's got the right information, if not, move on to the next link. But now what we're seeing is that users are logging onto these generative AI search engines. They are typing their question, asking their question, they're receiving an AI-generated answer. They're essentially taking that for gospel, and they aren't clicking links or verifying the information. So obviously, this is a big problem, because not everything that AI says is true. We know this, we know it hallucinates. And this can be particularly harmful in this situation where people aren't verifying information for themselves. And also, it means that the amount of false information that we're seeing and spreading and is being spread is sometimes covering up true information. So how do we make sure that accurate scientific information is being shared? So through generative engine optimization, which is the practice of structuring digital content so that these search engines can interpret, summarize, and cite it in their answers. There's been a lot of recent interest in GEO and sort of understanding how it works and how we can implement it. So what's been understood is that it does function differently from search engine optimization, which is optimizing content for it to appear in a traditional Google search where you get the list of links. You want your website to appear highest up, obviously. That search engine optimization, which we shouldn't completely ignore, but we do need to now consider GEO. So research shows that URLs cited by AI search engines rarely match what Google and Bing rank as top sources. I think if I remember correctly, a lot of these take into account websites like Reddit as a top source. But there is an understanding that some influence could be possible. So with these AI search engines, we can't influence the training data, but we can influence something called the grounding data, which is how the AI sort of verifies the information that's been given. So if you can do this through things like social media and websites, one of the tips that they mentioned was if you are answering a question in your post or in your website, you should explicitly type out the question. So, for example, say, what kind of particles does the LHC collide? If you were answering that question, you also want to explicitly type out the question, because then the AI is basically more likely to pick that up and include it in its answer. So it's definitely something that needs to be considered in science communications. I think it's also going to have quite a big impact in general communications and strategic communications outside of science. Okay, moving on, we're going to look at people's attitudes towards science and scientists. This is predominantly coming from a 2025 survey. This is the Public Attitudes to Science survey. From Ipsos and Ugarai, and it happens every couple of years. So the last one was 2019, which is obviously pre-pandemic. So this particular survey is giving us a lot of interesting information post-pandemic and with new technologies such as AI. So we're going to look at those in a bit more detail. First, this is just the slide to summarize the key findings. There's a couple I want to note in particular. So we do have a public that continues to value science, research, and innovation, which is great, but there is a new backdrop of uncertainty, ambivalence, and a loss of trust. And we have fewer people feeling informed in an evolving media landscape. So although we have, although people have more access to information, it doesn't necessarily mean they're feeling more informed. So this is definitely something that needs to be addressed. And there's also a desire for more diversity and participation in science. So just going into some of these in more detail. First, this is from the first chapter of the report, which basically summarizes general attitudes towards science. So 71% agree that science is a big part of our lives and we should all take interest. That's pretty good. There's been a shift from outright disengagement with science to something that's been connected passive engagement. So this is fewer people saying they're not interested in science and more people saying they're interested, but they're not actively making an effort to engage with science or keep informed. And we've also seen that fewer people are feeling well informed, which like we said, could be to do with increase in the amount of information that's out there and whether it's true or not. Then we have the people's views on science and researchers. So good news for the scientists in the room. 82% think that you make a valuable contribution to society. And most people associate you with top positive traits, being ethical, confident, honest, responsible, open-minded. This is obviously a good sign. One thing I wanted to point out in particular was this one, good at communicating. So 21% put this in their top three traits for scientists to have, which I think is particularly interesting. And what it sort of hints at is that there's an increased appetite for scientists to get involved in science communication. And this is something I'm going to touch on a little bit later. So this is actually from a slightly different survey. This is the Ipsos Veracity Index, which happens every year, and it's basically how likely you to trust a person based on their profession. It stays pretty consistent year in, year out. Nurses are always pretty much at the top, engineers, doctors to be expected, scientists just a couple down, 81%, and then all the way at the bottom we have journalists. So I think the key takeaway in this is obviously that people trust scientists a lot more than they trust journalists, not surprising, but what it really means is that we need scientists to get involved in science communications, because if all our communication about science is coming from journalists, that's how most people are interacting with science, it's not great, people aren't going to trust it. So what this means in practice is having scientists involved in comms by attaching them to quotes, getting involved in videos, media visits, things like that, so people are really engaging with them rather than just comms people and journalists. I do think there's kind of a caveat here that their journalists doesn't cover all people involved in communications. I think also if people were asked about the type of journalists, like whether they're reporting on science or a different subject, it could be different. But I think the key point there is pretty clear. So next is people's attitudes towards new technologies. So people are largely embracing new technologies, which is good. 2/3 agree that it's improving people's lives. But there is a lot of uncertainty around sort of the government's control of it and the speed at which it's developing. We want to make sure that that's all kept under control. The most touched on in this particular chapter was AI. And 33 of the people that felt at least somewhat informed about AI, 33% said they felt the benefits outweighed the risks, 36 said the opposite. There's quite a lot of, this is quite a polarized issue compared to say vaccine safety that had 80% felt the benefits outweighed the risks and only 8% argue the opposite. And as you can see, there's also a big gap in between where people are really uncertain. And I should say as well that when they were looking at people that were feeling more informed, this doesn't necessarily translate to them feeling the benefits outweigh the risks. So there's still a lot of uncertainty regardless of how informed people are actually feeling about AI. Then in terms of communicating with the public, the survey pretty much shows that people want scientists and those that sort of support science and regulate it to be engaging with the public as much as possible, especially about the sort of social and ethical implications of their research, especially with these new and emerging technologies. And I want to point out this one as well, because 56% agree that scientists should be rewarded for communicating their research to the public, which I think is pretty significant, that over half are thinking this, because I think it's hinting at people are aware that a lot of scientists can't prioritize communication, obviously, and therefore they should be rewarded for participating in it. And often we have barriers that are sort of internal and culture related, which I'm going to touch on a little bit more in a second. So as I spoke about earlier, we've seen some massive shifts in the media landscape from traditional to new media. This is basically just about how people were finding scientific information. So from the amount that were actively or passively seeking information, I'd say a large majority, or a majority at least, were finding it on social media or YouTube. And actually the survey said that in 16 to 24 year olds, new media has surpassed traditional media in where people are finding information, science information, with top platforms like Instagram, TikTok, and X, which is formerly Twitter. This has a direct implication for science communications, because the next generation of voters and taxpayers are finding their science information on social media. So we need to adapt to this and cater to it and make sure we have outputs that are targeted at these audiences. Fewer people trusting for the science-related information. Well, the survey shows that predominantly a lot of people are trusting the information they come across, and only half are verifying the information that they come across, which I think is slightly concerning, because, as I've said, not all science information you come across online is true. But in terms of trust, it was found that trust was equal across all channels. So they looked at the difference between like a BBC documentary, a TikTok video, a WhatsApp conversation with a friend, let's say, and they found that it was equal across all these channels. So it's not necessarily defined by the platform which they're finding this information. And it's not based on them verifying the information. It's actually based on the confidence that they have in the source, so the person or the institution that is sharing that information. So this is telling us that institutional credibility is a new major currency for science communication, and we need to know how to utilize this. Then science capital. So this is the sum of an individual's science-related knowledge, attitudes, experiences, and how this shapes their engagement and aspirations in science. And what the survey shows is that people with low science capital has decreased, which is great news, but people with high science capital hasn't necessarily increased. Instead, we've got this growing section with people that have medium science capital. And cool. How I think of science capital, so someone with high science capital, let's say, maybe they have a parent who's a scientist, they're studying a science at A-level, they read science books, they go to science fairs, you say they have high science capital. Someone with low science capital, they don't have any science in their like immediate circle, in their media diet, in their education. This means they've got low sign capital. It doesn't mean that they're not intelligent. It just means that their exposure to science is very low. So the big problem is that the middle is growing, but the top isn't. And why this is a problem is because we've seen a lot of really positive links between high science capital and general attitudes towards science. So as you can see here, the difference in high science capital and low science capital for things like supporting blue sky research, seeking science-related information, and agreeing that science increases personal prosperity. These are all positive things, obviously. People with high science capital agreeing with those things. So they're more likely to be supportive of blue sky research, they're more likely to trust scientists, but they're also more likely to be critical of science and of how governments are funding science. But overall, to improve general attitudes towards science, we need to improve science capital. Just to pick out two final things from the survey, which I thought were particularly relevant to PPD. 64% of the public agreed that the government should fund blue sky research, although this is down from previous surveys where it was pretty consistently in the high 70s. So it shows that now it's more important than ever to be communicating the importance of blue sky research. And then also this is a comparison of the public's trust depending on the institution that the scientist works for. So we have universities at the top, private companies at the bottom, and we're somewhere in the middle. So just to summarize that survey, so we have a public that values science and wants to hear more about it. We have scientists broadly trusted and respected and associated with positive traits. But we have a change in how the public are consuming science. And this means that more access to information hasn't necessarily led to our public feeling more informed about science. And finally, science capital is the strongest predictor of support for science, and therefore we should be investing in improving science capital. And how can we actually use the data from the survey? More reports, basically. So this report is the Public Understanding of Science Report from the Royal Society from 1985. It's colloquially known as the Bodmer Report. It was led by Sir Walter Bodmer. And this was a major turning point for attitudes towards science communication and public engagement, because it officially recognized public engagement as a legitimate part of becoming being a scientist. And it was sort of from then on embedded in the Royal Society's mission and the actions of higher education institutions. So it directly reshaped funding requirements and institutional behavior. And some of the impacts that we know is the creation of National Science Week for the requirement, sorry, for public engagement statements to be included in grant applications. Also, the requirement for research councils to fund public engagement and understanding, and also things like the Royal Society introducing the Faraday Lecture. So it's had a pretty significant impact in the last 40 years of science communication, whether people are aware of it or not. And it's why 40 years later, it's important that we revisit it. And that's what this report does. So in April of this year, the Royal Society published the Science for Society report, which is a direct successor of the Bodmer report. And importantly, it includes data from the Public Attitude Towards Science survey in a lot of its recommendations. The audience is primarily those in the research community, as well as those sort of surrounding it, so communicators, decision makers, funding agencies, etc. there's a lot of things in the original Bodmer report that couldn't have been predicted, and one of the main reasons this new report was written was to kind of assess the changes since the original report. So I just listed sort of the three key ones here. So obviously the digital world, in the time of the Bodmer report, this was sort of a great unknown, because only 13% of homes had a computer, the internet was just a couple of years old. But now we have instantaneous access to practically all human knowledge. And so this is something that is definitely, they've definitely reflected on in the new study. As I said, the digital world was the big unknown at the time of the Bodmer report. In the new report, it's AI. As we know, it's going to accelerate scientific discovery. It could support people's understanding of science and access to science. But obviously, it poses significant risks, and the public are deeply polarized about the issue. And then the third thing is misinformation, which is now operating at a scale that wasn't considered in the original Bodmer report. Like I said, we have unlimited access to information, and as I have touched on, we used to think of misinformation and fake news. So there's a big competition for sharing trustworthy scientific information. So what does the report actually touch on? So it recommends 20 key recommendations across these six themes, and within each recommendation is a series of sub-recommendations which are targeted at specific audiences. So this could be government, this could be the Royal Society themselves, this could be the research community, and it gives them sort of specific actions which hopefully will allow us to drive the same impact that the original Bodmer report had. But the unifying thread on all of it is that public engagement is an important part of the research life cycle, and it should be respected as such, and the scientists should be recognised and rewarded for engaging with the public. But easier said than done. As part of the survey, they included a new study, which I just mentioned, factors affecting public engagement by UK researchers. So this was a survey that was commissioned to understand the reasons why there's this disparity between scientists who want to engage and the public that wants to hear from them. And essentially, they found that it's because there's no time, there's no reward, and there's no structure in a lot of cases. So we have this gap where, you know, scientists that do genuinely want to engage with the public, and as we've seen from the BAS survey, we have a public that wants to hear more about science, but there's a gap. So how do we bridge it? Some of the suggestions were including science communication and public engagement training. This could be in things like grad schemes, in bachelor's degrees, for practicing scientists, also to have career progression criteria outlined for public engagement to encourage people to get involved. Also having protected time and resource for public engagement, and explicit outreach budgets. Because the problem is that scientists are our best, most trusted asset in science communication, and we want to hear from them, but we're not best supporting them in doing that. Another potential problem is something called the Sagan effect. This is after the late Carl Sagan, who was a renowned astronomer and science communicator. It was rumored that he was denied tenure from Harvard and also rejected from the National Academy of Science because he focused too much on his science communication and on his public presence. Whether this is true or not, people don't really know, but it does point at a certain stigma that I think still does exist, that some people think if a scientist has time to do public engagement and outreach, surely they have time to be doing more science. and they're not taking their research seriously enough. But the research actually shows the opposite, that engaging with the public and doing outreach can support career progression and support science, but there is still this fear for some scientists of being seen as not productive, successful scientists. So really the stigma doesn't match the evidence, but I think we are starting to see a bit of a shift with new science communicators, people like Brian Hawkes, Russ Tyson, Hannah Fry. You know, they're all decorated and successful scientists, and they have hundreds of thousands or millions of followers. And so they've built that public trust and that engagement. And so hopefully we can continue with that. The sort of key message, the other key message from the Science for Society report is that science is two-way street. It's really changed from when the Bodmer report was first written. At this time, a lot of science communication operated on something called the deficit model, which is essentially that the public are sort of empty vessels waiting for the wisdom of science, and that scientists control the flow of information to them. So it's very much a one-way street. And this was actually criticized in a House of Lords committee report in 2000. And I think since then, it's definitely started to change. So we have a new era where science is really becoming a two-way street. So we have things like citizen science. So for example, this is the big butterfly count, which I'm sure some of you might have heard of. Basically, you can sign up for free and we can count butterfly populations in your local area to support butterfly population research. There's also things like participatory research. This is particularly relevant in sort of healthcare studies. And also we've seen this desire from the public for more open dialogues on the ethics and implications of science, in particular new technologies. So just to finish up, I'm going to talk a little bit more about what comms PV does and how you can get involved if you're interested. I would love to go really in depth into all the various projects that I've worked on this year, which I've really enjoyed, but I'm just going to do a sort of summary. So our main sort of outputs, we have external comms. This is things like our LinkedIn. This is at the minute our sole social media. We used to have X, but now SDSC don't have X, but we have actually just recently surpassed the followers that we built on X on LinkedIn, which is good. We have the website, which I'm going to address in the next slide. We also have things like articles and press releases, which are probably supported by the central SDSC comms team. And then we have our internal comms. This is things like newsletter, TV screens around campus. We also share quarterly highlights from the department with the executive board. And we make inputs to things like the source and the SDSC webinars. As I said, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the website because we are getting a new website, and hopefully you've seen this. You've probably had a couple of emails from me about this. So I was hoping that by the time I did the seminar, it would be up and running, but we're about a week out. So hopefully by start of next month, we'll have this brand new website with our brand new accent color, which you might have seen I've been using throughout my presentation. This has been a really exciting project, and I'm looking forward to seeing it go live. As I said, within the next week, it should hopefully be up and running and you can have a look for yourselves. Then on the sort of other aspects of science communication is the public engagement. UPD does a lot of public engagement, and we are recognized as one of the better departments for it, I'd say. So we obviously have master classes, things like partial physics master class. We do work experience and engineering experience. We do visits and tours, and we also participate in things like the public access days. This is probably the easiest aspect to get involved in and how you can do this. So we have fortnightly public engagement meetings, which you're welcome to come along to at any time. It's pretty, if you're there, you're not committing to anything really. You can just find out a little bit more about what the group does and some of the exciting opportunities. You can also volunteer at our events throughout the year. One thing you can do is register as a staff ambassador. This is through the central public engagement team. So you'll be kept in the loop about the public engagement events that are going on across the campus and across the other SDFC campuses. And again, you're not committing to anything. And then also you're becoming a summer work experience supervisor. And then in terms of getting involved with the common side of it, if anyone has upcoming results, papers or milestones, it's best to get in touch with me or my replacement once I'm gone next month and share these things early. A lot of people might think that anything they have to share is too small or irrelevant, but I don't agree with that.
the
Yeah.
That's just a question.
They weren't doing
I think there's worse.
Oh, no, they weren't doing
they do work quite
Yeah.
small. Okay. Yeah. No idea is too small. Please do share what you have to say. You never know. Could help to kind of support what you're doing. And also, if you feel like it, please follow us on LinkedIn. And with that, I'll just summarize. Science communications is no longer vague. It's an open dialogue between scientists and society. The media landscape has shifted. We have things like AI and misinformation, which are posing new challenges for us. But there is a big public support for science, and we need to protect this and nurture this. And importantly, build science capital to help build positive attitudes and drive things like engagement in science. And finally, that you can and should get involved with public engagement. That's everything. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Otto. Thank you. Very nice. Any questions, please? Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions and a couple of comments, so I'll try and keep it short. So slide 24, when you were talking about the sort of fraction of people, you were saying that of the fraction of people that felt informed about AI,
Yeah.
what fraction was that actually felt comfortable or informed enough?
I don't have the exact figure. I'm sure it's in
Yeah.
the study. I can find it,
Yeah, I'd be
but that
curious
would
to
be
know.
interesting to know.
Because it's very clear from these numbers here that there is obviously a big uncertainty, but I think even
Yeah.
playing to the fact of like how much people felt comfortable to answer is
Yeah.
also playing
And I
to
guess it's also
uncertainty.
quite objective, people deciding,
Yeah.
sorry, subjective, people deciding how informed they feel because someone's fairly informed
Yeah.
if someone else is fairly informed. But
Exactly.
yeah,
Yeah.
I can definitely find that in the report.
Awesome. And then slide 27. You were
Yes.
talking about so this 48% number, you said you were kind of
Yeah.
concerned about this verification. I guess
Yeah.
maybe this is like an open question. I don't know whether like should we be worried that it's already this low? And you know, you were talking about generative engine optimization and the fact that because it's easier, people don't go and do their own research, they don't click the
Yeah.
link because it's right there. So is that number going to get worse, or is it going to get better because AI will get better at potentially linking things? Like, I guess I'm not expecting an answer, but
Yeah.
I guess I'm curious of like which way that will go, and you know, should we be concerned
Yeah.
or you know? So I guess just
Yeah, I guess it
respond.
depends what yeah, if it's
I
because
suppose it still depends on what's being fed into it. Like it's still
yeah,
gonna.
I
So
think
we,
that's the
I
thing.
suppose, like maybe the message is we still need to do better at somehow making sure that it can link it, even when
Yeah.
it does
I
improve.
think the main point is that people should check the information they're coming
Yeah.
across, especially if it's on social media or YouTube.
But hopefully, yeah, the AI will get better or there's some other way that we can mitigate that. But I could definitely see that things getting worse and
Yeah,
worse
exactly.
and
So maybe that's like
worse.
we're considering where we're at now. Like it's definitely on. And then two quick comments. So slide 30. So I think it's really just a thing we should, the fact that this is down like 15% potentially, I think is very reflective of, the financial landscape that we all currently are very aware of. And I think this is really pushing the message that we need to be better at communication, especially moving forward. And then the final comment I just want to say, hopefully I don't embarrass you, Ottilie, is just Ottilie has done a phenomenal job getting the website to the point of, almost getting it out. And it's a shame that it didn't happen this week, but I just really want to highlight that this is a really big achievement. You've done a fantastic job with the placement. I'm looking forward to that. And I'll shut up now.
So I've actually got a question and a comment. I'll maybe start with the comments. And it's regarding like the, like whether AI, like generative AI can be, beneficial or like, bad for our society. And I kind of want to highlight something that I heard on the Mindscape podcast with Sean Carroll, like some number of months ago. I think the guest that he had on is named Gordon Pennycook, and he studies, I am not kidding, he says pseudo profound bullshit. It's an actual term out in the academic sphere. You can go on look it up on Google Scholar and if you want. But I mean, it's a really difficult problem to tackle because it's just so easy to produce something that sounds profound but is in fact saying nothing. And like people like Deepak Chopra are accused of this all the time with things like quantum mysticism, and there are people like them are a target of science communicators, but the science communicators are having a hard time reaching the people who are likely to believe in it, largely because of this kind of propensity for people to get heated and sort of get argumentative with each other. So what this researcher has found and is actually kind of designing is a generative AI interface where people can literally just go and talk to a chatbot about things like vaccine misinformation. And he's found that it can be up to like 25% of hardcore conspiracy theorists have converted
Oh, really?
back to
So
like
it
back to the
tries
light.
to sway them.
It's not trying to do anything, it's just being patient with them. Because of that sort of combative nature, like it's very good at isolating. Like, I mean, I won't get into like, metaphysics and stuff like that, but I mean, like what is the self? But I mean, like this idea that, we like sort of separate ourselves from like the in-group and the out-group, that's a really efficient way to make sure that no one ever changes sides. So an AI chatbot will be really good at just sort of like, taking flak from like someone who believes in flat Earth or 5G causes COVID or like all that jazz. And like it'll just be like, I hear what you're saying, but here's the reasons why everything that you're saying is in fact complete crap, but in a much nicer term. So it's actually, I think it's an interesting thing that could be developed that will help with all of this.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And I, like I said, I wish I could obviously, rattle off the name of the study, but it's on the Mindscape podcast if you go back a few months or so if you wanted to listen to it. And my question, kind of related to that, is that when we're talking about like the distillation of scientific information to the public via things like AI chatbots and more directing this at the new media. Because I mean, like, if we produce more and more content, the algorithm that governs who sees what, I mean, like, vaccine skeptics and back and people who are just generally conspiratorial are not going to see that content. Whereas, if we can make like a million times more content on TikTok, yeah, you'll probably get more people seeing it in general. But like, the audiences that you want to reach, I think, are still going to be disproportionate of not seeing it. So like, is there something that, like maybe they talked about it at this conference that you went to? Like, what's the answer to that?
I think, like you say, it's hard to target those audiences that are so like far and so far in their opinion and stuck in that way. But I guess through the new media, like I said, this is fueling So if we optimize it, this could fuel the answers that these AI search engines are going to. So hopefully, I don't know if that could have any sway, but also maybe we're looking at targeting kind of the passively engaged audiences rather than trying to grab the people that we know probably never going to believe us. We can go for the people that maybe are skeptical, or maybe they're like a little bit interested, but they don't do any research or don't make the effort to keep informed. But there weren't really any, there weren't really any talks specifically on like trying to target those.
Or maybe not like set aside the, you know, like again, the people who are kind of like too far gone and will never switch sides.
Yeah.
Maybe except after a conversation with a chatbot. but how about like, okay, like when I think of, you know, like kids who are maybe like the algorithm doesn't know them very well.
Yeah.
But the fact is that it will try and funnel them towards like the manosphere, which is a huge problem that's out there. But like, so is there like a way that we can curate our own like outputs such that it's going to be like, I mean, I know that there's probably a way, but I mean, like the stuff that we do is probably not as eye grabbing as the fake news, right?
I think that's the issue. A lot of the fake news is, like I said, it's a very emotional thing, so people are more likely to engage with it. They're either, what's so shocking, is this true? And then they go and share it. Because I guess what you're saying is like, can we just put out as much information as possible? But I don't know if that would solve anything. Maybe it's we need to tailor our comms more specifically to audiences, but I already think that especially with our social media outputs, like across SDFC, I think they are targeting a general audience, and then I'd say it's more with the public engagement and outreach activities that we're targeting those younger audiences. So maybe we need social media that is targeted to those younger audiences rather than just a general audience, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I don't know how to make that content. Maybe we need a class on it.
Yeah.
Hi. So thanks for the talk. I guess I sort of wanted to follow up on what you were saying about, you know, the algorithms directing people to harmful content. I mean, I think, you know, since you already touched on this idea of the regulatory side of science not being able to keep pace with technological advances, this is something where we need to be more active and we need to be more vocal, because if you look at what's going on right now with blanket social media bans for under 16s, this is an enormous threat to data privacy for everyone, right? And we as technologically literate scientists need to be raising this point, and we need to be raising the alternative solution of things like, well, why don't you ban addictive algorithms? Why don't you ban algorithms that direct people to extremist content? You know, why don't we go back to chronological timelines on all of our social media instead of recommended content? This is a less harmful pathway for everyone, not only for children, but also anybody who has to upload a copy of their passport to look at YouTube, which should be terrifying to everyone in this room. So I think, in addition to, you know, everything that you mentioned, we need to take a more active voice on the regulatory side of science as well, not just the public consumption.
Yeah, I think that's true.
That's March.
Yeah. Regulatory towards social media as well, as I keep saying.
Yeah, because I mean, as you said, everyone thinks, oh my God, why don't we think of the children? Because this fake news does feed on fear, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah, we're sort of trying to cut it off the audience side rather than that, where the actual problem is stemming from, which is the addictive algorithm. So yeah.
And all of the predatory companies that want to collect our data are whispering in the government's ear saying you need to do this, and we need to take an opposing point of view.
Yeah.
Now, that's a very good point, actually. Why bring up what we do? We do peer review, right? So what we're doing with science is we're checking the science that is being done, making sure that when it's going to go out there to the public media, we think it's correct. We're not absolutely correct or sure that it's going to be correct, but we actually do peer review. Now, none of these organisations do peer review, except you hinted at that. You had a chatbot that actually could look at the content and then actually identify, is it correct or not? Now, couldn't we identify, say, algorithms that can check these algorithms and make sure that that's okay content? Now, that's what we should be doing as scientists. And we should be putting that into the government's framework of controlling these AI companies so that we actually are in control of the peer review. So we're actually putting everything through a peer review system, but it's a chatbot. And then, of course, people will complain about that because who did the chatbot? Scientists. Yeah, that's the other
thing. But they trust us.
But I can also bring up another thing. The say the government, well, the government don't trust us at all because they don't like scientists to be in control of science. They want to be in control of scientists, not us being in control of our own science. And it even comes down to the point where some of the scientists in this organization will not be allowed to come to this lecture because they are not being paid for the hour that they spend here. So they've got to identify a cost center to actually come to this lecture. So if I can tell you that PPD is very good, other departments are not good, but we have to go over this burden where even our own organization has a sort of almost a sort of a ban on scientists coming to lectures because they have a cost center.
And you do the Green Ammonia seminar.
Yes, and there is a seminar that you've organized that is in the future. They have to pay the person to actually make the content of that seminar and come here and pay his time. So you weren't paid for the 1 hour here, were you? You've got a cost center, right? So who's paying you to come here? So we have to break these barriers, actually, because this is how science is actually communicated between ourselves. Not we're all in the box, actually. We need to break down these barriers down right now, rather than try and break barriers down in the public. We've got barriers ourselves.
But I have heard from the engineering people, for example, from RAL Space,
yes,
they would very much love to come to this.
They would love to come here,
but they can't.
Yes, that's right. They'll get a barrier because he can't give them a cost center to cover their time to come here.
Wow.
Now, I guess many people in this room don't know that.
Yeah, I didn't
know that. PPD is very, very generous because all these guys sitting here are all paid to sit here and listen to this talk here, which is a great talk, by the way. Really. But I think it's very important we have to start looking at our own backyard and making sure that we actually can get out there and get the content that we're actually producing distributed throughout the whole world.
I mean, we are advertising this on Mahila Engage.
Yes.
And lots of people who see the advertisement, mm-hmm, but they don't dare to join.
That's right. Well, the senior line manager would say, well, why are you going to this lecture? We're not paying you to go to the lecture. Mm-hmm. We're paying you to do this work. And this is something that people don't really understand.
I've been at RAL 88 headquarters for an established 1990, and I'd never encountered that in my, and I wasn't in PPD when I first came here. I'd never encountered that.
That's right. Yeah. You're PPD. PPD are great.
And I was in the space science for about 12 years before, yeah, 13 years before I ever encountered in space science.
So now it's creeping through all the departments. But going back to the original talk, shouldn't we be deriving algorithms that actually can check? Because that's what peer review is. Scientists themselves are checking the paper and they're looking at the flaws or arguments that are down in the paper. So we should be doing the algorithms, that go through all these algorithms that are out and see if they can beat them.
So it always still comes back the time, though.
The point is that if the government and you made a very good point, we're actually, cutting off the some of the best talent by not allowing 16-year-olds to look at certain content. Now, I know it's harmful content, things like that, but they're not going to be able to look at anything if they don't have access to internet and things like that. So we're actually destroying a whole generation of brains there. Mm-hmm. And so it's like saying, if you're under 16, you can't go into the library because there are harmful books in the library. So we have to actually make sure that we are in control of the data, not the AI companies who make a lot of money out of it.
Hello, I'm interested to talk. Thank
you. I'm
from CLF. Yes. I'm used to Bob, but I do know about the RAL space thing. I can tell you that capital can't every single hour. I agree, it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I have a sort of a comment and a question that you may or may not be able to answer. One of your slides towards the end was that lovely picture of the front of Bloodford Acton Laboratory, the brick wall. And Atlas Lab behind it.
Yes.
I agree, it's a lovely picture. But my problem with that photo is it's the wrong laboratory. It's got one name at the front and a different building behind.
I always assume, yes, it's like
that. Well,
I do know where this is relative.
Okay, in which case I have another point to make to you. I've been at the lab almost as long as my colleague at the end here, nearly 40 years. I'd be really interested, as a lot of people will tell you, in the history of the site, sort of the site historian de facto, which is why I particularly picked up on that. The fact that you don't know what it is the first thing we should talk about. You also said happy birthday, RAL.
Yes.
Are you referring to our 70th anniversary next year?
That was...
Okay. Does that mean the answer is no?
I do remember when I was making this particular post that there was
this was a real one. There was like multiple different like tiles. Right. And I remember I sat with on something. There was a bit of discussion about like timelines and stuff.
Make sure
it was
okay,
the right definition of things.
This was an AI generated slide.
I think my point is it says one thing and then the picture's the other. But what I was actually trying to say was that 2027 is of course the lab's 70th birthday. I have asked Central Comms whether they're planning anything at all. There's a thought they might do something for the 75th. That's no good for somebody retired by then. Do you know if they're doing anything for the 75th? Well, I mean, Bob has plans.
With the passing of Norman.
Well, yes, we discussed this, but we haven't. I mean, I think other departments are discussing it in detail. So we should talk later.
Yes.
About this.
Yeah.
Now, the big problem, because Norman died.
Yeah. Well, hell, I can do that book now.
I know you were writing a book with. So that's a big point.
Actually, just a couple of comments. I should say, thank you. Really nice talk. And just want to echo Oscar's comments about joining public engagement meetings. So we have them every couple of weeks, and encourage people to come along. Just come along and see what's happening, or if you've got something you want to contribute, people more than welcome.
Well, they should contact you if they want to get involved.
Yes, but I'll send emails out for meetings, so feel free to just pop
them. Yeah, so you mentioned about this three top social media, and that we are not in either of them, right? Like Instagram, TikTok.
Yeah, so PPD just has LinkedIn, Central STFC. Has Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. I think they still have X, but they don't post on it. So PPD is just LinkedIn, but SPFC has more accounts, and some of the bigger departments like ISIS, they have a couple different platforms, but just PPD is just LinkedIn. People are kind of discussing alternatives to X. There's some
blue sky,
which is really something. True social. So maybe that's something we'll see in the picture, but for the minute, we are just.
Question. On slide 37, is the picture AI generated?
The cartoon.
I'm going to assume no, because
every single statistic was made up.
94%
of all statistics.
Yes.
I just another sort of comment that I kind of just remembered off the top of my head right now. So another way that I think we can engage kind of like in an informal way. There's lots of science communicators who are making content on like YouTube, TikTok, and all these other social media things. And like there are some that are like, you know, quite dogged in their they will go out and do like these crazy debates. Like, I mean, like I think we might have all seen like this, you know, surrounded format on Jubilee, like where you have like Dr. Mike who went and talked to, you know, a bunch of anti-vaxxers, or you know, I think there was one with flat earthers as well. But it means suffice it to say, like, these are science communicators who are like, their whole job is to just be in the public sphere and have these sort of like the more combative engagements with people who are, you know, trying to like, you know, sow this, you know, this bullshit out into the public sphere. And I have personally reached out to Professor Dave, or Professor Dave Explains, trying to say like if there's anything that we as scientists can do. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, yeah, like you can, you know, participate in podcasts, but like, you know, we as science communicators need like, you know, people to interview, we need people to like you know, edit our, or like, you know, go over our scripts to make sure that everything is like kosher. And they're clamoring for more of us to, you know, to engage in that way. So if you're not like willing to go onto like, you know, podcasts or interviews, or like, or if you're like me who like absolutely sucks at debating, right, like you can still participate by reaching out to active science communicators who are better trained at the more combative stuff, and say, I can, you know, I can be part of your team in the background. I can give you like the, yeah, you know, if you don't want to be patient like a chatbot, you can just, but like they'll, you know, debate people who are, you know, like the active disinformation artists, like RFK Jr. or, you know, like the Discovery Institute is a huge thing, entity that we should all be scared about. Like,
and I think,
you know,
audiences find that format really engaging.
Yes, yes.
People argue is entertaining, and people will take away the right messages from those videos.
Yeah. Reach out to just like a lot of them just have emails that they post on, but like they have, you can just send them a message and say, I am, you know, so and so from Rutherford Appleton Lab. And then, you know, maybe even we can, you know, like be official, like have an official partnership with, you know, some of them even.
We are approaching the time, but are there any questions on Zoom?
I don't see on Zoom anymore here. Maybe I just want to ask for your opinion whether, so, like Joe was saying, is it worth having training, for example, for Huntington's disease or for SDFC, like the other trainings that we have to take? I know they're
online.
Always.
Yeah.
They're online.
Yes.
I guess, yeah, that's like an SDFC wide thing. I think it would have to be.
Yeah.
I think the best way to like get involved at the lowest levels is to come along to the public engagement meetings. Then you have at least like some understanding of the kind of outreach that we do. But I think, yeah, maybe that, I haven't heard that being raised as a possibility, but I guess it would make sense. I don't know if people would be reluctant, given that it's just another training.
Yeah, exactly.
People don't love trainings, but
But it's something that keeps reminding people.
Yeah.
Or otherwise, we need seminars from the student like yours.
Well, we have at least one seminar like this every year.
At least one seminar a year from public engagement.
Time it with a heat wave and promise AC.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Many years ago, I mean, we had training actually. Yes, this is going back about maybe 25, 30 years. Where you would actually, it was run by Reprographics in that area, in that group actually, who do the photography as well. So you go in and actually prepare a 5-minute, it was a TED talk, you had to do a TED talk. It was not called TED talks 25, 30 years ago, but that's what it was. So you had to go in and prepare something that you actually went in front of a camera and you gave your school. And there were people there criticizing afterwards and what you should do.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do this, don't do that, etc., etc. Write up a critique of what you did, and then you come back after you've prepared it again and do another spiel in front of the camera. But that's all gone now. I think that's because there's no money.
Yeah, I know that the central comms team does like media training. There is, but that's predominantly the people higher up. Like,
yeah,
most people here won't do that. So yeah, maybe something like that. Was it popular?
Very popular. I mean, I've got a sort of half hour on black holes where I sit down and talk about black holes. Now, it's out there, you can watch television, but it's in 2 or 3 in the morning, actually, sometimes. You know, I don't watch it anymore.
Can this be uploaded to YouTube or someone?
I suppose it can, actually.
Yeah.
But that's half an hour of black holes. I mean, you don't want to know that's good. More than you really want to know about. I mean, TED talk in 5 minutes is perfect for most people. When it goes to half an hour, that's a long.
And a quick one. I know you it's down for funding, but would you have benefited if there were 2 students, if you had another colleague in our group? Is there enough work for them?
I think, yeah, there would definitely be enough work. There would be more that we could do.
And how would you feel if there was another student? Would that have benefited your work as well?
I think so, yeah.
Someone to talk to.
Yeah, it's hard to judge having not had it, so I don't really have anything to compare it to. I've just had my experience. But
you're currently doing supervisors too, right? Ashley and Stuart.
Yeah.
So I think that should be enough.
There's common students in the other departments that I've worked with occasionally, so.
I think there's definitely more scope though, because I mean, I remember sitting down with Otto and we were kind of thinking about all the things we could do, and that list went on for ages and we just didn't have time to do it. So I think there'd always be more scope, and I think there's always, yeah, we should be working towards more engagement. So,
concerning the training, I can advertise you that we do have a PPD exhibition room guide training, and then it's not a lot of people joining. In the training, we have so you will come and then we will introduce what we have exhibit in our exhibition room, and also Sophie will say how do we explain this properly, nicely according to different audience.
I think as she mentioned in one of her slides, do get involved in the STEM ambassador list. That is very, very helpful if you really want to be.
Why are we not calling it a STEM ambassador, by the way?
Sir?
A STEM ambassador.
STEM ambassador?
That is the name of it, in my mind.
It's my plan.
Okay,
indeed. Thank you very much.
Well, one of the models needs to be a little bit more close.